an opportunity for the public to provide brief comments on items relevant to council business, but not otherwise listed on the agenda. Ted?
Hi, Ted Platts. I'm a Gilnetter from Newport, Rhode Island. I've spoken to this council before on this issue regards the horsepower, tonnage, and length regulations, which constrain every fisherman in New England's ability to get a boat that is a proper size for a fishery. As we switch now to quota management, fishermen need to have the adaptability and the flexibility to get a boat that suits a fishery where you're going to be allowed to be efficient. We're going to be allowed to bring in significant size catches rather than a boat whose configuration is emphasized on small catches and low overhead. There's a lot of people that are negatively impacted by these regulations. You have lobstermen who are looking now to get out of Area 2 and into Area 3 and have to drop their groundfish permit because the boat that they would take for an offshore fishery versus a day boat fishery does not fit a permit that they hold for groundfish. So with their limited groundfish holdings, they'll drop them. The same thing is happening in a number of fisheries. The real cutting edge on this is that these regulations provide no benefit. They don't help the stock. They're not a means by which we safeguard the health of the stocks. They tie up NOAA personnel reviewing to see if your boat that you wish to purchase is 6 inches too large for the permit you bought. You can only round up 1 foot from your percentage increase. You have horsepower constraints. We have all kinds of constraints on fishermen that do no good. They're doing no good at all. They're tying up personnel in the government, and they're constraining our ability to survive. And whereas 2 years ago when I raised this issue, I could accept the fact that it was a back burner issue and there were too many other important things being considered and dealt with at that time, that is no longer the case. We have monkfish moving into sector management in September of 2010. We have groundfish there now. We have a completely reconfigured scallop fishery. And we have regulations on the book that are injuring every fisherman's ability to adapt and are providing no value. I mean, as things are presently set up with holding these regulations on the book, a fisherman needs to buy a $100,000 to $200,000 permit so that he can get the vessel of the size he wants. Then he can go spend a couple $100,000 on the vessel he needs. So you're adding $100,000 to $200,000 of overhead cost to a fisherman just to get the right vessel. For what? What's our benefit there? And that overhead cost has a real negative effect on a person's ability to survive. It will accelerate and add to consolidation. And I don't believe that anyone on this council can say that these regulations are doing us any good. And I think they need to be removed as we move into catch share management. And I think this now is a priority issue. And I think it is not the only one. We have a lot of relics from our past, and they need to be removed from the books so that fishermen can honestly go about purchasing the vessel they need and try and survive into the new era. And these regulations are of no value to the stocks or to anyone else. Thank you.
Paul Howard.
Yeah, Council, I think that's a perfect issue for Interspecies Committee. How does, if a vessel has all catch share permits, then there's no reason why we should restrain, you know, his vessel. But the issue is, if he's got a permit for a species under a catch share and one that's not, and the boat becomes larger, he will be able to catch more in the same amount of effort with a larger, newer boat. So that's an issue that should be discussed under interspecies when we look at issues and recommendations for catch share programs, and it should be this upgrading looked at as well.
Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is one of several issues of this type. Another one is unnecessary closures in light of quota management, and I think that we need to stop hamstringing industry with these kinds of regulations that are no longer required. And I would like to make a motion that we task the Interspecies Committee with doing just this job, just what Paul just said.
Yeah, we don't need a motion.
Don't need a motion? Good. Makes it easier.
Mary Beth?
I'm not sure it is an issue for the Interspecies Committee. It is an issue for each FMP to consider. There are social impacts of all these decisions. Doing away with upgrade restrictions certainly does create efficiencies within fisheries that should be considered. We have a lot of people in this region who have interest in maintaining small boat fleets, large boat fleets. I mean, this raises a whole host of issues. And certainly there are a lot of good reasons that I can think of. I've been working quite, you know, hard the past couple of years on upgrade restrictions in other regions of the country. So I'm not anti, you know, allowing upgrades, but there's a whole host of things that need to be considered when you do that. And it's going to be different for each FMP. The Interspecies Committee is not going to be able to, like, deal with all of that. I mean, I think it's part of the development of any catch share program that needs to be considered, and, you know, and that's the appropriate place.
Okay, I'm back in the public. This is the public period for comment. Chris?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if this is the appropriate time to discuss my proposal. Maybe it is. Okay. Before you is a proposal for a study fleet for winter flounder. In listening to Nancy Thompson, we have a stock assessment due June 2011 for winter flounder, and as near as I can tell, we will have no commercial activity other than a 50-pound state waters fishery prosecuted between now and maybe then. As the president of the association that probably holds more winter flounder quota than any other sector, we are frustrated that the council has possibly looked at it as a closure as a solution to the problem. A closure cannot be viewed as a solution in our eyes. Managing implies activity, and we just don't see any. You know, we have been patiently waiting for some sort of a long-term strategy to emerge out of this process. And let me say that I recognize how hard you have worked and how long the hours and how broad the range of subjects that you've had to deal with getting to this point. But we do have a closure on the table for down here, and it is devastating. I don't know that oftentimes you have it put into perspective. I have 500,000 pounds of winter flounder history that I accumulated over 10 years of fishing. I'm pretty average in southern New England, and that is by far the largest holding of my groundfish. That is our codfish. That is the equivalent of the Western Gulf of Maine cod or Georges Bank cod. It is what we need to get by. So in keeping with the policy of not just complaining but having something to work with, I submitted a proposal, albeit rather late, for a study fleet where commercial fishermen would be able to access their potential sector contribution of winter flounder. They would be required to live on that small amount of fish for the entire year. They would accept it as a hard tack in their large mesh and their small mesh fishery so that we could construct a protracted analysis of mortality and get about the business of managing flounder accurately. Winter flounder are an enigma. They do not perform as other stocks. As someone who has targeted winter flounder my entire life, it makes perfect sense to me that they act the way they do and respond the way they do. But when you manage them as if they are a regular ground fish, you will fail every time. About 95% of the tows that are made in southern New England are made in pursuit of other stocks, and oftentimes with small mesh. It is illogical to think that you could ever have a profound impact on the abundance of winter flounder simply by controlling 5% of the activity. The statistics of discards do not bear out what I see and what I know in my heart. There is an enormous discard problem in this small mesh fishery, and sectors hold the key to providing the incentives within the fishery to avoid winter flounder. I think at some point in time, this council will have to manage winter flounder differently maybe than other stocks. You may have to apply a hard tack to individuals so that they are given the incentive to avoid what they cannot avoid, they will be able to sell. We can't look at flounders that are sold via the large mesh fishery as being the only problem that we have. I don't know exactly where this proposal will go or how it will be received, but I do know that we are unable to move the scientific perception of the stock absent any commercial fishery dependent data. So this was an attempt to evaluate and empower sectors and move the ball. Earlier on in the year, it was decided that winter flounder would not be allocated to sectors. It was done out of mercy. It was done so that sectors could succeed. I respect that, and I am appreciative of any consideration that is offered as merciful. But the reality of things is not enough is known about the fishery to know at what level we can actually open it up. As we transition away from a closure, are we just going to transition to a higher rate of discards, or will we turn the fishery back on, and at what point and how? I think that it's probably a good idea to look at making the acceptance of personal sector contribution as voluntary as being a way to turn it on first. There are fishermen in southern New England right now who could thrive and provide the scientific data if they were given access to their personal sector contribution. If, well, the stock is incredibly low, if most of the fishermen aren't able to, there are certainly some that could. I think we have an obligation to those people and an obligation to science and an obligation as a council to try to solve the problem, if you will, by facilitating as many people as you can in the act of being responsible fishers and providing data and making a few dollars with what they have for their history. So in light of that, I really don't know what you can do with this time-wise. It's going to be difficult. I talked to the Groundfish Committee. They suggested that I try to go for a special access permit or some sort of a research proposal at a different level. But I think the council needs to state clearly that it is your intention to undo the closure as quickly as you can, even if it is by degrees. The nature of the fishery in southern New England is such that I oftentimes would target just a box or two of flounder as part of another fishery. We target fluke and scup and sea bass and other things, and just a box or two of flounders makes it better. Well, those fisheries are all going on right now, and the discards are piling up. There are tragic consequences that occur if your assumption that the problem is with the directed fishery is wrong. It means that when you close down the directed fishery, the problems get worse. I really think we need to take a special look at this fishery, understand the relationship that the Mid-Atlantic Council has to it, and look at all of the sources of mortality before we think we can fix it strictly by towing a big bag. So if you've had a chance to read the proposal, I await your comments. A message that I could take back to the fishermen in southern New England that this council is not happy with a closure and is working towards doing all they can do to open the fishery, even if it is by degrees, would be appreciated. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. I say to the chair of the MID, we have our NRCC meeting coming up in a few months, and as part of that process, we're given the SBRM report or the allocation of sea days for the upcoming year, and we bring them back to our respective councils. It could be that both councils could ask if there are extra days or available days to direct them into these small mesh fisheries to collect better data on bycatch of winter flounder. And that's a possible thing we could do. And we'll have to weigh it against all the other competing fisheries for those sea days, but It just, as you were speaking, it just popped into my head. That is one thing we could do to possibly illuminate this situation a little bit.
Okay, thank you. When you go from, when you have a strategy that says we will not allocate to anybody out of the concern for the new management regime, you're going to lose a few people. You're going to lose a few people. And then you need to contemplate how you transition from one to the other. When you turn it on, if you turn it on before the last guy is happy, then you will lose him. So you're going to lose people at both ends of the transition. If you allow for a voluntary transition into accepting the PSC and look at it as a hardtack fishery the entire year, including small mesh discards, I think that is an incredibly important component of managing winter flounder. You have to put the incentives in place to make guys try as hard as they can to miss juvenile flounder when they're not targeting that stock. So that's the good thing about sectors. The bad thing is we haven't got around to allocating to them yet. So
I guess my point, Chris, on my previous comment was that when you raised this issue at the groundfish committee meeting, staff informed the committee that the data didn't reflect. In the small mesh fishery, the data just didn't seem to indicate the magnitude of problem that you've told both the committee and the council exists with those fisheries on southern New England blackback. So it seemed to me that, you know, we it's tough for us to make decisions on hunches or statements from the public. We have to have data to put into our documents to justify our actions. And so it seemed to me that a logical step, one part of a logical step towards what you're asking about would be to direct some observer effort into these fisheries to start to document what you're telling us.
Okay, thank you. You know, currently we're allowed to have 5% discards of groundfish within the small mesh fisheries. If you look at the amount of small mesh fish that are harvested within the range of groundfish, it's probably in the 30 to 40 million pounds annually. And if we are really efficient and only have 1%, I think the numbers get pretty staggering pretty soon. And when you contemplate the size of the fish that are saved in small mesh, you can have up to 200 or 300 of them in a basket. So the mortality numbers can skyrocket, even though the percentages seem kind of small. So I don't need a small mesh fishery, and I don't need a winter flounder fishery. I need them both. And I'm afraid that if we don't do something sooner rather than later, that the fate of the small mesh fisheries in southern New England will be compromised. And that's the last thing I want to do is lose the small mesh fisheries. And I don't want to lose winter flounder either. Thank you.
Dave.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that intrigued me about this and that I think drives it is the fact that if we look at GARM 3, the flat stuff in general were the species that showed retrospective patterns. And with the blackback flounder, it was the one species where the retrospective pattern could not be explained or worked out through some kind of mathematical jimmying. It never was fully explained. And it was clear from the conclusions that were written on blackback flounder that the scientific staff were not comfortable with the conclusions that they were reaching with blackbacks. I think we need to get more information on blackback, and that's what I particularly like about this proposal.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chris, when you did come to the groundfish committee and we made the suggestion of having you work with the service for an experimental fisheries permit, I understand that you know as originally conceived, there may be some, you know, problems with this, but I continue to think that trying to work with the service, and maybe they have suggestions as to how this can be tailored to generate some of this information that we are ultimately going to need to make the right decisions and how to open the fishery, how to control it and stuff in the future. So, I mean, I think everybody on the committee thought the concept of this and the kind of information that would come out of it was very beneficial. But, and so I just want to urge you not to get discouraged, but I would keep working with the service on trying to come up with a way to get an EFP, and then that comes back to us for comment in the normal process.
I think one of the conversations that we need to have, a short one, is that if I approach the scientific community and say I have, you know, 40 or 50 boats that want to be part of a study fleet, they're willing to accept their PSC as a hard tack for the entire year in all fisheries, they're willing to take observers, be part of electronic logbook, measure and weigh every fish. Would you recognize the fact that 644 tons of estimated dead discard coming from the Science and Statistical Committee is the same as 300 tons of landed in a hard tack formula and 344 assumed? I guess that's the kind of a stretch that I'm going to ask this council to make, or to at least discuss.
And my response is, you know, that goes back to that. That's sticking to the format of what you originally conceived. And I'm saying, well, maybe there's another way to do this in a partial form, or maybe it's not the entire study fleet, or you know, something. So I just say keep working on trying to get it done in some iteration.
Pat?
Yeah, Nancy may want to comment too, but at least from the experimental fishing permit perspective, I got to be honest, this is going to be really, really difficult. The scientific advice was to reduce fishing mortality to as close to zero as possible. And in lieu of a total closure of the southern New England area, we went with the possession limit restriction, which actually does allow more fishing mortality because of the discard issue. And so if Amendment 16 is approved to allow harvest of that resource, sort of in contradiction of the way that it's been proposed to be managed, it's going to be very hard.
I guess that's – I knew you were going to say that. I knew you were going to say that, but the reality is when the SSC says this is how many flounders will die because other fisheries are ongoing, I am that other fishery. Me and 30 other boats did not simply arise – for the opportunity to harvest these flounders. We are doing just, we're getting by, we're doing other things. And if you were to allocate to a study fleet of this size or the kind of poundage that we're looking for, there would be virtually no directed flounder fishing, but it would give you a snapshot of our peripheral fishing. In accepting a hard tack within a sector format, we wouldn't have the luxury of directed fishing. I think it is important, the most important part of this is to see how flounders are getting killed and caught in other places. The observer effect is a real thing. When there are flounders around and people don't want to show them, you don't see them. It happens. So I think it is fair to claim a portion of that, the 644 number, if you will, for to document what's happening, because it's happening anyway. I neither appear nor disappear, on command. I'm ongoing. I'm an ongoing enterprise, and that my mortality is already contemplated in that number.
Chris has actually passed this proposal to us, and we're in the process of evaluating it from a scientific standpoint. And I think what, first of all, everybody needs to understand is from a stock assessment standpoint, we can do assessments without fishery-dependent information. Having said that, we are looking at the questions that are being raised by Chris and his colleagues and working through those to figure out if there is a way that we can develop some data sets, for example, for discards, discard rates, discard mortality rates, that are doable from not only a scientific standpoint, but from a management standpoint. We may come to the conclusion that we may not be able to do it, but we are, in fact, taking a look at it now. But I do want people to understand that in the absence of fishery-dependent information, we can pursue assessments.
The industry is incredibly frustrated at the utility of the council in that there is almost nowhere for us to plug in and be of assistance where we want to be of genuine assistance. It is in our best interest that we do not overfish, that we do not exceed the mortality projections of the SSC, and that we achieve the goals of the management plan. We want to do that. There are a lot of people in this industry that are dedicated to making that happen. And it's very frustrating for us to get that input to the council and have it hit the road. I don't know if the PDT is receptive to our advances. It used to be years ago, and then a few years back, we pretty much got asked not to dance anymore. So I don't know if in these times of enlightenment, the PDT should be made more accessible to the public. I think that would be a pretty good first start, and I would feel better having another podium to vent.
Well, I'm sorry you're frustrated by the council. I mean, we don't control the science. We don't control the dollars. And the issue you raise is one of many issues that are part of this complex management process. And if we had a place for everybody that had an issue to plug in, we'd never do anything else. And that's not me pushing you off. That's just me telling you what I've told you privately. The reality is that the policy decision to go to a no retention solution was viewed as a better choice than some of the other choices, or all the other choices on the table, which included a complete shutdown of the area. Doesn't help you with the particular issue you've raised here. And I think that there are other avenues and other places for you and your colleagues to go to demonstrate what you're seeing, what you're telling us you're seeing, that would happen much quicker than even if this body engaged. If this body engaged, you're looking at best shot 2 years before something hits the water, in my estimation. I mean, if we were able to drop everything and really put whatever focus and whatever pressure we can on the system, you're looking at 2 years. Whereas if I told one of your fellow fishermen from Rhode Island the other day, another place you may want to look at is talking with NEMAP and talking with states at ASMFC and trying to put together a package down there, because they can move a lot quicker than we can. It's just an idea. I'd personally be happy to sit in, once you get to a certain point, to sit in with you guys and try to help you think things through or be a resource to you personally. But I don't think this table can do much for you today on the issue. But I don't want to discourage you. I know you may be discouraged, but it's not an issue that's going to go away. And we just need to find the right place to bring it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. There is a consequence of not allocating that you have to be aware of, and I would be remiss if I did not remind you of it. When you teach the fisherman that a fish has no value, he has no regard for it. If days at sea taught us nothing, we should know that. I've been told by a number of fishermen that flounders are closed now, they will be closed forever, and we will never target flounder again as long as we live. So don't worry about them. If you have to kick them out the scupper. If you have to fish through them, fish through them. And that's the kind of thing we're trying to avoid. You will never have collective concern replace individual responsibility. I've said that time and time again. I suggested it for the scallop fleet with the yellowtails at the Groundfish Advisory Committee, and I would recommend the same for myself. This stock would recover infinitely faster with a small allocation, so that guys could mix what they could into their regular fishery, than it ever will being held away from them. It's just the way it is. The last thing I'm trying to do is suppress the recovery of this stock. You have to know that. So, anyway, thank you for hearing my words, and I am not at all discouraged. I had plenty of time to think about what I was going to say yesterday. This is, I think, the third time I've come to try to talk about this, and not at all discouraged. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Chris. Okay, anyone else? Yes, ma'am.
My name is Susanne Altenburger. I'm not discouraged either. I was first talking before this council in spring of 2003. We designed Bows of Gloucester. My husband's been doing this work for 57 years. And we thought in the ramp-up to Amendment 13, one way to support the industry and therefore the shoreside support infrastructure would be to emphasize a way to live with less catch in anticipation of higher fuel cost by examining opportunities in research and development of different geometries would make more sustainable fishing boats. Some fishermen have taken to this. You know, we've been talking about it forever. National Fishermen covered this story off and on, most recently with a small entry-level example in the November issue of National Fishermen. We're not in it for the big money after 1900 hours. We're deep in the hole on this one. But a lot of folks have supported this, including Conservation Law Foundation, Eco Trust of Canada out in BC, folks that you've heard of from recently in the context of EDF proceedings. Local stakeholders are with us across different tribes, different fisheries. And yet, even looking at the FAO document 2003 about how you define ecosystem management, which includes the human element, biotic, abiotic, and other elements of the ecosystem, it seems that on this council level and in general throughout the industry, there's still not much resonance of going beyond the single pole approach to stability of the resource management. The way we talk to each other about this is you actually would need a tripod of sustainability. One is sustainable resource, which you folks have been working on, scientists have been working on, regulators have been trying to enforce things. Many amendments of various bits and pieces of regulation to make that happen. But what doesn't get discussed is a sustainable fishing fleet. What some of the gentlemen were talking about, how much does it cost to go to sea? I would suggest to not go larger. I would suggest to go leaner and by the gentleman who wants to go bigger. But we don't find it anywhere reflected on what you good folks are doing here. There continues to be a monodimensional focus on just the resource. And folks told me we do fish, we don't do boats. Now, the irony, of course, is that once you're regulating fishing vessels by length, by horsepower, by tonnage, you're knee-deep, shoulder-deep, waist-deep, whichever way you like it, depending on the tide, you are deep into defining hardware. So you are deep going far beyond fishing and resource management. And but still, when I look at what your group is doing, your institution is doing, including the recent workshop August of 2009 here in the same building, I presume, about ecosystem management, defining what it means, we're still going back, obviously veering back to counting living creatures, which is a good thing, but it's not the only focus we should be looking at. I didn't see it at ICES out of Denmark until 2008, approximately. Very slow on this one. I don't see it in your research steering committee. Nobody's doing the work either. In the meantime, last summer, we were all hugged and kissed the hard way by almost $5 a gallon for diesel. And now, with the Amendment 16, see, I'm down on my last sheet. During the Amendment 16 discussions, we hear EDF comes through the door with Big Brother Pew in the background, and I like the image of Batman and Robin doing this thing. They sound sensible enough in some ways, but ultimately what we've noticed from our maybe a bit too skewed perspective, but we do design boats, and we do have a record of trying to go at it the lean way, meaning the sustainable way, is that those two institutions which have acquired so much presumed political power, they have no paperwork, no conferences held, no national competitions run, no press announcement that remotely touch on vessel economics and how that affects resource management, particularly in the ecosystem approach. Their definition of ecosystem management, now pushed all the way into very close proximity of the White House, is a monodimensional approach which will not make Ms. Lubchenco look good. It will certainly not amuse the Congress or Mr. Obama, because this is an unstable proposal. We only focus on the resource. We don't focus on the fleet. We don't focus on shoreside communities and their sustainability. So you end up with a situation where you, I find myself here listening to you. You're working on 16 to the final details of it. And there still is no focus on the actual definition of sustainability as an ecosystem management approach, a comprehensive one, the tripod, the resource, the fleet, the shoreside communities. Without any of one of these three, you're not going to go anywhere at all. And so when I listened to EDF, and Julie Worms came to town last week with her friends from Alaska giving Gloucester folks a quite mismatched perspective between Alaska versus Gloucester and New England sector would be experienced. Nobody really saw much connection there, and what occurred to some of us was that EDF's current proposal, particularly with this private investment club angle attached to it, the privatization of the ocean between sand and the surface, that was about as green as mountaintop removal in West Virginia to go after coal. This is really ugly stuff. This is unfermented. This is coming from folks who have not done any bit of intellectual homework when it comes to defining sustainable fishing fleet. Again, to repeat, no conference held, no white paper issued, nothing on their websites, not a single bit of vocabulary, no semantic literacy in casual conversation that this might matter how we live with $5 a gallon. And I'm not ghoulishly fear-mongering here. $5 a gallon we saw last summer. That already has been shot across our bow. Even if it was on high on steroids in a crazy economy, we're looking at similar realities in short order. And what this council has not done, and apparently won't do under 16 either, it will not focus on how do we keep those guys who will remain standing, how do we keep those guys prepared for $5 a gallon by regulation and by encouragement. So I think the question might be, despite all your strenuous efforts over the years, and I've been attending just a few of these sessions of yours, it is very hard work and quite unnerving at times and difficult subject matter. But I wonder ultimately what your legacy will be. Because you may be jumping into bed with EDF or not, or you modified or not, but your legacy will be one of leaving this industry in the year 2009 with a hardware structure, a fleet structure, a vessel economic structure that has deep roots in the 70s and 80s. Design-wise, construction-wise, principles-wise. It's like running an advanced taxicab company in Boston with Checker Marathon cabs versus a Camry hybrid. Who's going to win that one isn't a question. Some folks raising the issue of seafood supply security if you face $5 a gallon and nobody's prepared for it. That is something you're doing, have to focus on, and you're not focusing on it. So to wrap this up, is I'm wondering whether in your... We tried to raise this issue earlier this year. My husband talked before you. We got no feedback from any one of you in the last 9 months. That's quite a stunning experience. We burned serious hours and money on this. Maybe it's about time that you may focus on what does it take beyond fish, beyond the resource, beyond anything that has been the preoccupation to reread the 2003 FAO focus on what does it mean to do ecosystem management. The tripod, not just a monopod. A monopod will fall over the moment you walk away. What will be your legacy? And how do you leave the shoreside communities? And I think the Batman and Robin team, I suspect Julie Worms are in the Northeast, and she says privately, I'm all for it, Suzanne. I wish you good luck, good fortunes. I like those lyrical words. But she also tells me that EDF New England has no wordage in their portfolio, in their task for her, what she's supposed to do. Does this have anything to do with vessel economics? Nothing to do with sustainable vessels. Nothing to do with producing the equivalent of a hybrid on the water. The equivalent of what everybody's straining to do in building construction, airline management, airplane design, cars, trucks, trains. Nobody works in this universe, and you guys are part of the universe of transportation, whether you like it or not. You do resource extraction and transportation. There's nobody in the universe that's burning liquid fuel that is not focusing on reducing, not just for purple prose language, but for economic survival sake, reducing carbon footprint. And you folks aren't doing it. Your scientists aren't doing it. The Northeast Consortium is completely off to lunch. There's nobody there who talks to us. Your research steering committee isn't doing it. ICES is doing a little bit, but very half-hazard, still deeply mired in the old zombie regulation in terms of their focus. And I'm wondering how long it will be before you folks think it might be a good thing to focus on the broader picture, because what always motivated us, I'm wrapping this up, what always motivated us was the understanding that if you're facing $5 a gallon, pretty much for good. I can't tell you what date and what hour of the day that will be, but it will happen. The only way anybody's going to be going fishing will be to do this with the shorter steaming distances from the port to the resource and back. You can't afford to go hither and yon and do it the old-fashioned way. It will not allow you. $5 won't allow you to do this. I don't know what will happen with New Bedford, their fleet. It's super high carbon. I'm not living there, so... I just lost my train of thought. Lucky you. I would entertain any questions you folks might have. I think there is a very serious embarrassment potential on it, not because I say so, but because it is so. It's the only industry in which nobody cares about carbon footprint, not because of the language. This is non-denominational. This is not green versus Republican versus Democrat versus pink versus anything. I'm burning 200 gallons for the complete 12-month heating season in my house in New England because it's my own money. It's survivalist economics. It's not I'm so green. If you get federal tax credits to put new windows in the house, why does this council not have any research going on? Why does MIT, the council, why does nobody have any research going on how you prepare the industry? With the hardest of work of representing the industry's interest, the scientists' interest, regulatory interest, policy interest, you'll be all whacked by $5 a gallon. Your work will be overshadowed in ways that is heartbreaking. It'll be ruinous. And the problem is, I've been coming in my thumb-fingered in inept ways. I'm not good at doing any of this talking. I've been coming here for, I'm entering my eighth year. Next spring it will be through 7 years total. And still no resonance. That's quite wild. I understand the triage mentality. We've got to address key issues. I've heard it from Vito Gigolone a lot. But even he at long last is coming around, yes, and we never meant to imply we're not for this. So I'm wondering whether you folks might find it in your hearts to consider during this very difficult work of Amendment 16, and this is not going to work probably at all in your mindsets, how you'll address this the biggest of challenges to not be the only industry of transportation resource extraction which is blissfully high carbon over many years despite repeated admonitions, nudgings, and gentle suggestions that you will not move. And one thing that will happen with this one, it would embarrass Ms. Lubchenco, and Mr. Obama won't like this at all. You don't destroy jobs in an era like this where we need to create jobs. And you don't do it with a Robin and Batman team that are into high carbon ventures. And high carbon doesn't look good either. So you folks may be the last line of reason to examine, maybe we should slow this whole thing down. So maybe we should look at some more ways of doing the same thing. Last thing. Shorter steaming distances to the theater means many different locations, lots of small to mid-sized boats. And small does not mean offshore capable, incapable. It does not mean that our boats have crossed the Atlantic on 18 inches of draft and 30 feet of length. If you design the boat to do that, you will survive that. You don't do it in the middle of a winter gale, but nobody goes fishing there either. At least they shouldn't. And I'll take the liberty of sharing with you a slightly inflammatory handout. I handed out to 250 fishers who showed up at your headquarters up at Nero in Gloucester on October the 30th. I'll do it quietly behind your seat back here so you won't be distracted from further important business. I appreciate your patience with me. I will keep coming. There's a groundswell of interest going, at least in Gloucester. We're going to build a greenish boat again this coming spring if everything works out. We don't need anybody's permission to do so. Obviously, we don't need to. But you folks need to set policy priorities. If you don't, I think any time before Thanksgiving next year, kids will Google your name and say you did what. Nephews and nieces can be quite cruel when you are the last high-carbon entity left standing in a universe where even children know how to do the right thing. And you're not as yet doing the right thing. Thank you. Oh, you might have questions, possibly. Or maybe you're so flabbergasted, so annoyed, and you just stand struck that you'd rather see me leave again.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and do Red Crab.